The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, it's Patrick Cox here. And how healthy is the Russian language? What kind of future does it have? Does it have a future? You might think I'm being silly here. Russian is spoken by millions of people in Russia and many other countries. But the number of native Russian speakers worldwide is shrinking, as is the number of people who are learning Russian as a second language. Famously, Eastern European nations, they turn their backs on Russian pretty quickly after the fall of communism. And here in America, parents aren't exactly clamoring to get their kids to learn the language either. We'll get into the matter of the future of Russian globally in a bit, but here first is Alina Simone in New York on Russian learning here in the United States.
When my editor Patrick assigned me a story about how the Russian language is dying, I thought he was being funny. I pointed out that, yoo-hoo, I speak Russian, and so does my entire family. I invited, no, dared him, to step into a crowded elevator in New York City and start complaining in loud Russian about someone's BO. And then I headed to Bright Minds Center in Manhattan for graduation day, where classes in Russian are offered for kids aged 2 to 15. And business is booming.
In the first year, we signed up 60 kids. Since then, now we have around 300 families.
Anna Volkova, co-founder of Bright Minds, told me the school has expanded so fast since 2008 that they are now looking to open a second branch. But when I ferried this news back to my editor, he directed my attention to a national survey conducted by the Center for Applied Linguistics, which paints a different picture. Russian now places last amongst foreign languages taught in American elementary or secondary schools. At just 0.3%, it ranks behind Greek, Arabic, and Native American languages. That wasn't the case before the Iron Curtain fell, but the U.S. government's interest in Russian studies was closely tied to their interest in keeping the Soviet Union in check. Here's Russian language expert Kevin Henzel.
When the Soviet Union first collapsed, the language money went away from Russian and went into Ukrainian and Kazakh and the Baltic languages because there was no capability in the United States. And then after 9/11, all the money got pulled into Arabic and Pashto and Dari and Urdu and a lot of other languages. So in a limited pool of dollars, you tend to move those around to where you feel there's going to be a need.
That need hasn't been keenly felt here in the U.S. for years. And the former Soviet satellite countries are dropping Russian as a second language faster than Vladimir Putin can say Pussy Riot. Without government funding, interest in learning Russian depends more on its pop appeal. But even during the Sochi Olympics, the cultural ambassadors Russia touted were mostly dead. Safe to say, there just aren't a surplus of youngsters out there jonesing to read Tolstoy or Dostoevsky in the original. But there is still one place where Americans are required to know Russian. And that's outer space.
Utyosy, this is Mission Control Moscow. How do you read? Utyosy, this is Mission Control.
Starting in 2011, NASA made learning Russian a requirement for all astronauts. The same year it began relying on Russian Soyuz rockets to reach the International Space Station. But recent tensions over the crisis in Ukraine have had the Russians threatening to end their participation in the International Space Station program. That doesn't mean American astronauts should put away their Russian grammar textbooks quite yet, as Kevin Henzel explains.
The Russians take some delight in being the means by which the Americans are able to get to the space station. And there's still a fair amount of decent science being done up there that can't be done really anywhere else. So I think what you're going to see is certainly the effort will continue.
Paradoxically, the chill that settled over U.S.-Russian relations may actually end up driving us back into Russia's arms. Linguistically speaking, that is.
Within the government, I think they're looking at it and saying, you know, we may have run away from this a little bit too quickly. Let's put a little bit of money here. Let's put some more chips on the table. Let's be aware of the advantages that knowing a language give us.
And yet, Kevin reminds me, Russian will never again be as widely spoken as it was when the Soviet Union straddled the globe like a sumo wrestler, threatening to sit on countries that dared to say niet to Russian. But just as I was starting to feel depressed that one day Russian would just be a lonely secret I alone shared with 144 million other native speakers, I met up with linguist John McWhorter, who reminded me just how unlikely the spread of Russian was to begin with.
Russian is really, really hard. And I say that as somebody who loves Russian.
I love it too, but that doesn't mean I always speak it correctly.
Just all of the jangling stuff on the nouns, all the bric-a-brac with the verbs. Just try to say something as simple as I went to the store, the verbs of motion, tried to count. It's a magnificent nightmare.
You'd think the languages easiest to learn and speak would also be the most common, but it turns out tanks and bombers spread a language much more effectively than the promise of regular verbs.
So it just shows that there's nothing about the way a language happens to be put together that allows it to spread and become a language of empire. Any language can become a language of empire as long as certain conditions are met.
Of course, politics and war aren't the only way a language can spread. 40 years ago, we may have had a lot more Americans speaking Russian as a second language, but the number of Russian immigrants in the U.S. was infinitesimal. Not so today. At Bright Minds Center, 90% of the kids studying Russian are from mixed parentage, with only one Russian-speaking parent. And the other, says Anna Volkova,
They can be French, they can be Italian, they can be German, whatever, you name it, Japanese.
Many of the kids end up being trilingual, like Dmitry Golden's daughter, a student at Bright Minds.
Now my daughter speaks fluent Russian, fluent Spanish also because the mother's Dominican.
As they say, languages are best learned on the pillow. Or to put it another way, to Russian with love. For The World, this is Alina Simone from New York.
Okay, we're going to hear a bit more now from Columbia linguist John McWhorter, who's becoming a bit of a regular on the pod. McWhorter's pretty bullish about the future of Russian, even in those places like the Russian Caucasus and the former Soviet states that are independent now, even those places with their own local languages. Listen here as John McWhorter tells Alina Simone that Russian is in fact entrenched in all kinds of non-Russian societies because when it came to town, it arrived with textbooks. Unlike, say, English.
English has spread throughout the world in the form of many creoles where people basically had the language thrown at them. Russian is different in that you can go into some permafrost-encrusted place with people who are living on the land, and the Russian that they speak is not a pidgin Russian or Creole Russian. They are actually speaking the Russian that originated over in Russia. And that's because Russian has been imposed mostly within a situation where there was education. And so whatever people would have spoken if the language had been thrown at them, and we can be quite sure that that would have been a Russian that was broken and then built into a language again. And there are some Russian pigeons that have happened. We can be sure that's what would have happened. That did not happen because people were taught the language in school, there was media, and so for that reason, people in, say, the Caucasus Mountains speak actual Russian rather than some sort of improvisation on Russian that became a new language. And so what's interesting about Russian is that you see it's spoken by all of these different people, and you would almost expect, given what languages of empire tend to be like, that Russian out in the Caucasus would be much simpler than the Russian that Putin speaks. And actually, it isn't. Whereas if you look at, say, Indonesian, the Indonesian language has been vastly simplified in order to spread among the, I think, 250 million people who speak it. It is not the classical Malay language that it was 600 years ago. That's the sort of thing you usually expect. There'll be a Haitian Creole instead of a French. Portuguese is spoken in all sorts of ways that are on a continuum of that kind of simplification followed by being built into a new complex language. Russian is just Russian, but that shows that if you get a language into people's heads early, and especially within the confines of education, then anything can be passed around relatively intact.
So what's the fate of a language of empire once the empire falls apart? Once there's no political incentive to, you know, keep people speaking that language?
You know what? Language is about habit, just like everything else. And if you have a group of people where for generations and generations the sense has been that Russian is the language you see on TV. Russian is the language that you get a job in. Then we have our own language, and that's the language that we use at home. That's the language that you play games in. That's the other one. Then what you get is a situation that specialists call diglossia, where one of the languages is, I hate using these terms, but you can't pretend they don't exist. One of them is high, and one of them is low. In my classes, I call it the H and the L, as if that doesn't make it clear what we're talking about. But still, it's not that one language is better than another. If Russian is the H, it will be very hard to shake that sense among people going through their lives. And so even if Russian itself has increasingly less political status because of what seems rather likely to be happening to Russia as a country over the next 50 years. Wait till somebody listens to that in 50 years in case I'm wrong. But I think we all know what I'm talking about. Right. But if my guess is correct, still, it's going to be a long time before somebody in the Irkutsk or somebody who is speaking a Caucasus language is not going to think of Russian as a key to the wider world. That doesn't mean that they don't love their native language. That doesn't mean that they don't resent the domination of Russian over time. But I don't see it being eclipsed unless there are radical changes in the educational system and in the sense of what it is to be a cosmopolitan person for someone who wants to be. To chuck Russian entirely would be a very abrupt decision, and you are what you grow up in. So it depends on what children are raised in.
Interesting. There's certainly plenty to suggest, though, that the Russian-speaking zone is shrinking a little, certainly in Eastern Europe, but also in some of those ex-Soviet countries, places like Georgia and some of those Central Asian nations. The Russian government has even noted this. But yes, Russian still is an official language in several ex-Soviet states. And yes, it's a popular unofficial language in some others. So I guess it's a mixed bag. Okay, here is John McWhorter predicting which languages Americans will be drawn to in the coming years and which ones are dropping out of the picture. Here goes.
When I started teaching about language 20 years ago, I could count on most of any class knowing some French. That changed about 10 years ago, and I started to realize me putting up something in French and expecting the whole room to know what it is getting a little 1946. I noticed that really the language I can count on most of them knowing is Spanish. That's going to continue because we have so many Spanish-speaking immigrants here. Frankly, I think the new fashion, just as learning some French was a fashion back in the day, I think that Mandarin is going to be a fashion in that way. I could be being too pessimistic, but given that pedagogical techniques for imparting Mandarin at this point are somewhat preliminary in many quarters, I think it's going to be hard for a lot of people to get beyond the first two or three stages in learning Mandarin. People are going to know some words and some phrases. I'm not sure how far at least this current generation is going to get in actually handling Mandarin, outside of some programs I know of that do a very concentrated job. But man, you have to work really hard. More and more Spanish, less and less French, and on Russian, we'll see. 20 years ago, I could assume that no one in a class of hundreds at Berkeley was taking Russian, or maybe one person, or there'd be a few kids whose parents were Russian. Here at Columbia, and I think it's partly because we're in New York, but partly because times have changed, because Russians were not scarce out in the Bay Area either. Partly, I can know that there's going to be a contingent of kids who know what I'm talking about if I throw some Russian on the board, and generally will often know Russian much better than me as a spoken language. And so I think Russian is going to be around. I crystal ball think that Russian is going to be more attractive to most kids than Latin because it's spoken. Increasingly, you're going to date somebody who speaks heritage Russian from home. I'm seeing that happen with undergraduates more and more. It's there, Russian and Polish, but Polish is even harder than Russian. So Latin will be less useful than Russian, but ultimately it's going to be Spanish, and I'm going to get in trouble for this, but there's going to be Spanish and a kind of boutique Mandarin, which is going to become very common, but mostly Spanish.
John McWhorter, always great to have him on the pod. And I'll post links to a couple of other episodes in which he has appeared. They'll be at pri.org/language. Also, check out soundworks.org. That's the home of our podcast network, this pod and three others. Among them is a podcast called One with Farai, that is Farai Chidea. And in her upcoming podcast, It may already be up by the time you hear this. Farai speaks with Mr. Digital Diplomacy, Alec Ross. You know, the guy who worked in Hillary Clinton's State Department as Senior Advisor of Innovation. He made quite a lot of news doing that. He logged nearly 1 million air miles also doing so. Not digital air miles, I'm guessing. Real ones. Check it out at soundworks.org. I'll see you on Facebook at the World in Words page or on Twitter, where I tweet under the name Patry Cox. PatriCox. See you next time.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.